previously on Unsolved. At the time of 14-year-old John Zara's death in 1976, Elaine Samuels was an associate medical examiner for Milwaukee County. Errors Dr. Samuels made while investigating various crimes would make it difficult, if not impossible, to bring criminals to justice.
There were two cases involving two rape cases where the semen samples were not handled properly and the evidence in those cases had to be destroyed or couldn't be used in court.
The Milwaukee County Board would ultimately eliminate Dr. Samuels' position as an associate medical examiner. But decades later, her errors would become a problem for investigators on the Zara case.
Subsequent to interviewing the doctor that did the autopsy, I was looking for something in 2001 and on. I was looking for the swabs used to collect the samples. They no longer exist. She claims that the cops from Hales Corners told them to throw away. Well, I personally don't believe that happened.
In the notes of the autopsy, Detective Schoonover found this just little phrase in Dr. Samuels' handwriting, and it said, semen in rectum. And that sounded really strange to him because he had read the entire autopsy report, and there was no mention of semen or preserving it or testing biological evidence like that.
We had very, very high hopes, and those were dashed very, very quickly with the there's nothing there.
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, a murdered teen, a 40-year mystery. I'm Gina Barton. Even after numerous false starts, Detective Kent Schoonover of the Hales Corners Police Department remained determined to solve the 1976 homicide of 14-year-old John Zara. In 2009, Daniel Acker was 62 years old and serving a 20-year prison sentence for two counts of second-degree sexual assault of a child. While the police were investigating that, they found a shrine to dead and missing children in Acker's basement. They also found a photo album and journal that detailed Acker's own personal investigation into John's death. That led Detective Schoonover to move Acker back onto the suspect list. And since Acker could potentially be spending the rest of his life in prison, Schoonover thought Acker would have nothing to lose by admitting he had killed John. But Acker wouldn't budge. He maintained his innocence throughout all of Schoonover's questioning.
He wouldn't give it up, obviously. He didn't confess to killing John. You know, he still has this huge fondness for John. He still feels guilty about John's death. He still has a huge fondness for the family. He still feels that he should have been able to solve this case for the family.
Frustrated, Schoonover turned to DNA again. The state crime lab hadn't found DNA on the slides from John's case. The medical examiner, Dr. Elaine Samuels, had thrown away the swabs that she used during the examination of John's body. So investigators at the state crime lab started looking at John's clothing, and they finally found a new clue. One of John's socks contained unknown DNA. But there were two problems with that DNA. One is that it was only a partial profile. So a full profile is a genetic fingerprint that narrows it down to one in billions of people. A partial profile, on the other hand, would only narrow it down to one in a couple thousand people. So that was the first problem with the DNA on the sock. The second problem was that there were three strands that the DNA was contained on. And in most cases, there are only two strands. So this told the investigators that either the person who killed John had a rare genetic condition, or most likely the sample had somehow been contaminated, probably by the investigators back in the 70s who didn't know what DNA was and weren't taking any precautions to guard against contaminating it. I talked with Dr. Michael Cox, a biochemistry professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about what the issues with the DNA from the sock could mean. For one thing, there's no way for investigators to tell when the DNA landed on John's sock or whether it's there because of something innocent or something malicious.
Yeah, it's very hard to say. You don't know You know, it could be from someone that did this kid harm, and it could, might be from a friend who was just around, you know, 2 days before the attack happened and got hold of his sock when he was tackling him in a little football game or something. You know, there's just no way to tell.
But now that Schoonover had some DNA to work with, he could begin comparing it to different suspects, starting with Acker. They also tested the sample against Michael Yaporsky, a substitute teacher at Franklin High School who had been in their crosshairs for decades. But once again, investigators would be disappointed. Dan Acker's DNA did not match the DNA on John Sock. When they got that result back that there was no match between Acker and the DNA on the sock, Schoonover and all the other police he was working with were so frustrated. Because by this point, with all the creepy stuff, all the disconcerting stuff in Acker's basement, they were more and more certain that he did it. And they felt like, okay, he won't confess. If we get his DNA, that'll be what it takes to solve the case. But it didn't work out that way. The DNA on the sock was problematic because if it didn't match a certain suspect, that didn't necessarily mean he was innocent because there were all these issues with the DNA. If it did match, that would be a good circumstantial clue, but it definitely wouldn't be proof positive. Here's Schoonover talking to Ron Witucki, an analyst at the State Crime Lab, about the results of some of the DNA testing they've done so far.
The two that we've already tested, Michael Yaporsky and Dan Acker, have already been eliminated.
Okay.
As far as that,
as far as that partial profile
is concerned. They haven't been eliminated totally as suspect.
The next thing Detective Schoonover did after the DNA result came back was did his best anyway to try to put together a circumstantial case against Acker to take all of these strange and suspicious things that Acker had done. He put together this package and he sent it to the district attorney's office and said, hey, I think this is our guy. Can we make a case against him? And the prosecutor said, no, there definitely wasn't enough evidence against him to charge a case. At that point, Detective Schoonover had been working on John's case for 8 years. He'd put off retiring for 3 years, and he decided it was time to finally accept that he wouldn't close John's murder. It was time for him to move on.
This case needs to be finished, and I didn't finish it by the time I retired, and it was the one real regret I had when I retired that this case wasn't done. I didn't finish it.
But the investigation into John Zara's death wouldn't end there. Today, the police chief in Hales Corners is Eric Serra, and the detective in the department, they only have one detective in Hales Corners, is Justin Landry. And those two guys, earlier this year, decided that it was time to resume active investigation of this case. This case hit home for Serra and Landry. Serra's dad grew up with a kid who later became a Hales Corners cop, and was on the force at the time of John's death. Landry used to play in Whitnall Park as a kid. He had no idea about the tragedy that had happened there.
It's a little unnerving to know what kind of people hung out in the park while we were kids. Just the kind of closeness to danger that we were not even aware of at the time.
When Detective Landry came in and started looking at this case, his plan was to just look at the whole thing fresh. And he didn't want to see any of Detective Schoonover's notes. He didn't really want any information about what the other investigators had concluded. He wanted to just start fresh and see what he could come up with. Here's how Landry and Serra went about that in Landry's own words.
Yeah, I think once Chief Serra and I tackled this, we wanted to take a fresh look at it. So we began by organizing the reports in chronological order, reading every single report, putting everything in a spreadsheet so it makes sense, trying to lay it out. That way we could keep a running tally of names and kind of see what we had to do for the investigation.
This new approach would once again raise questions for investigators. Here's Chief Eric Serra.
Detective Landry was working on that course of action, and late last year he had come to me and said, you know, I have some reservations, or I'm starting to get a different feel for the suspects and the routes we're going. I think we may have tunnel vision on this. We may want to address this a different way.
Landry was less than certain about some of the previous suspects in the case. The construction worker, who Detective Hingis back in the day in the 70s really thought was the guy, Landry didn't think he was the guy. I mean, all this time had gone by. The construction worker grew up, got married, had a child, was raising his grandkids, had a business, hadn't been in trouble with the law in 40 years or 30, 40 years. So he didn't seem suspicious at all anymore at this point. Mike Uporski, the substitute teacher who had that strange history of playing with kids' feet, same thing. He had gotten married. He had two successful adult children. He was able to rebuild his life and build a new career in sales after he got fired from the Seattle Supersonics. Dan Acker, obviously, like everyone else, Landry is suspicious of. But whereas a lot of other investigators think the only explanation for all this strange stuff in Acker's house is that he's the killer, Landry's kind of alternate theory is, well, we know Acker's a child molester. So maybe after John died, Acker tried to get close to John's family because John had two brothers left behind, a 13-year-old brother and a 15-year-old brother. And while Landry was wading through the 6,000 pages worth of documents on this investigation, he noticed something alarming. Back in 1967, there was a kid named Steve, teenage boy, hitchhiking on his way back from football practice, as kids did back then. And a guy in a laundry truck picked him up, asked him if he wanted to go on a couple of deliveries. Steve said sure. But then what ended up happening is the driver of this laundry truck took him out into the woods, assaulted him, beat him over the head with a tree branch, threw him in a ravine, and left him for dead. So Steve was missing overnight, but then the next morning he crawled out of the woods and survived. Detective Landry saw some parallels between the case of Steve and the case of John Zara. They had both been sexually assaulted. They had both been beaten. Both been left for dead, although Steve didn't actually die. And the tree branch that was used to beat Steve kind of reminded everyone of that tree branch that was in some of the pictures from the crime scene with John, but that no one ever preserved as evidence. Also, both of these assaults took place in wooded areas, and they were about 20 miles apart. The assault on Steve was in Mequon, and the assault on John was in Hales Corners. But both of them are pretty close to Highway 43. James Lee Crummell was identified as the laundry truck driver who abducted Steve in Mequon. He was charged with that assault, and he was sentenced to an indeterminate time in prison due to some mental issues that he had. So the police thought that Crummell would be locked up for at least 30 years for this heinous, terrible crime against a teenage boy. Actually, he was out in 5. When Steve's dad read about John's case in 1976, he called the police and told them it sounded a lot like what happened to his son. Investigators would try to find Crummell, but he had violated his parole and left the state. Eventually, the FBI tracked down Crummell, and he was living in California. So they hauled him back to Wisconsin on his parole violation. And he was questioned about John's case, both in California and in Wisconsin, by Hales Corners police and by the FBI. And he simply said he had nothing to do with John's death. He hadn't touched a teenage boy since Steve back in the 60s. And he claimed that he was not even in Wisconsin or in the Midwest in 1976. He said he had been living in California all that time. During the early investigation into John's death, the investigators were really into lie detector tests. That it was this great new tool, almost like magic. And so they were asking everybody to take lie detector tests. Well, most of the people went ahead and took them. But when they asked Crummell to take one, he said no. And now, police tell me that a better indication of somebody's guilt is not whether they pass or fail a lie detector test, but it's whether or not they agree to take one, because someone with nothing to hide generally will take one, and not taking one is suspicious. Decades later, investigators would discover even more reasons to be suspicious of Crummell. The other thing that Detective Landry found when he was going through the files and the information about James Lee Crummell is that on his right wrist, Crummell had a tattoo of a picture of a devil and the phrase "born to raise hell." And when Justin told me this, I was just like, no way, you've got to be kidding. Because on exactly the same spot on John's right wrist, somebody had written the word hell in ballpoint pen. And so that struck Landry as a really, really strange coincidence. Unfortunately, back at the time when John was murdered, neither the police nor anyone in the medical examiner's office took a picture of that word on his wrist. So there's no way to compare it to the tattoo. There's no way to compare it to the handwriting in Acker's journal. There's no way to use that as evidence. That wasn't the only information detectives were able to dig up on Crummell. Here's Chief Sarah again.
As it turns out, as we're doing just the basic case review and reevaluating everything, one thing that popped out at us is this third guy's address is an address in Brookfield that also happens to be the address where James Crummell, the serial killer, resided when he was on the lam for his homicide in Arizona.
In 1967, in Arizona, the police found the body of a 9-year-old boy whose name was Frank Clausen. And they found Frank Clausen's body not far from his own home, which was also 3 blocks from James Crummell's home. And a jury ultimately found Crummell guilty of murdering Frank Clausen, but a judge later threw out the conviction, saying his lawyer was ineffective and that, you know, justice had not been served because he didn't get a fair trial. So he got out on that one. Frank Clausen disappeared in February 1967 in Arizona. And then Steve, the boy from Mequon, was assaulted here in Wisconsin in August 1967. So if you follow the paper trail, by the time Crummell attacked Steve, he had already murdered Frank Clausen. And then in 1979, a 13-year-old boy named James Trotter, his family called him Jamie, disappeared on his walk to the bus stop in California. And he was missing for years. They couldn't find his body. They had no clues. They didn't know what happened to him. And then in 1990, Crummell led them to Jamie's skeleton out in the woods. And Crummell said he had been hiking and he just came upon these remains and he called the police. Even then, it took them until 1997 to charge Crummell with killing Jamie Trotter. And with the wheels of justice turning slowly, he was finally convicted of that murder in 2004. And that conviction stuck, and he was sentenced to death. When Detective Landry discovered all of these suspicious activities and crimes by Crummell, of course, he wanted to go talk to him and ask him again about John's death. Unfortunately for Justin, but maybe not so unfortunately for some other people, James Lee Crummell committed suicide on death row in 2012. Even though Crummell has died, by the time he was in prison, they did have his DNA on file. Here's Chief Sarah talking to the analyst at the State Crime Lab about that.
James Crummell, we already compared a partial profile. California had one.
Oh,
on file.
Right. That was the California guy.
Yep. We compared the partial profile to him.
Crummell's DNA did not match the DNA found on John's sock. Although it would have been great, and it would have been a good piece of evidence if Crummell's DNA matched the DNA on the sock, the fact that it didn't certainly didn't prove him innocent. Investigators continued to experience false starts when it came to DNA. At one point, they discovered some untested stains on the sheet that authorities had used to cover John's body. They sent it to the crime lab for testing, but the only DNA that was found belonged to John himself. The final avenue at this point of DNA testing that Chief Sarah and Detective Landry are going to look into is called touch DNA, or epithelial DNA testing. And the state crime lab here did a little bit of that back in the day. They tested like the zipper pull and a couple of other places on John's clothing. But what this kind of testing can do is a simple touch of the hand can leave behind skin cells. And so what they try to do is determine where did the assailant touch the victim. So in John's case, probably two really promising places to do that type of testing are on his shirt, because he had bruising on his arms that indicate somebody had grabbed him by the arms, and also around his jeans pockets. The police believe maybe somebody took his hall pass out of his pocket, might have taken some other items out of his pocket. So that's what they're planning to try next. Here's Cox, the biochemist.
When you pull your keys out, you're leaving skin cells on your keys. When you grab a doorknob, you're leaving skin cells there. When you're wearing your clothes, you're leaving skin cells inside your clothes. Forensic scientists know how to pull those out. And they do it routinely. It's not an unusual practice at all.
The results from the touch DNA tests are still pending. In the meantime, Landry and Sarah would forge ahead with other avenues of investigation. They've asked Richard Walter, the FBI profiler from the last podcast, to question Dan Acker. Walter still considers Acker a primary suspect in John's death, although he has backed off a bit on his theory that Acker could be a serial killer. In addition to calling on Walter for help, Landry and Sarah have sorted through the 1,045 people named in police reports throughout the almost 40 years of this investigation. They came up with 105 leads that weren't followed as far as they could have been. Five officers were added to the investigation. And a detective we've heard from many times throughout this podcast would come out of retirement and sign on as a consultant. I'll let you hear from Detective Kent Schoonover about that.
So when Eric and Justin talked to me about they're going to look at it again, I was very happy that they decided to do that. And I'm very happy of the process that they're choosing to do, being open-minded, starting from scratch. And I feel very fortunate that they've included me in on it. I get a chance to take one more shot at this. And I think with Justin and Eric, we can get this done.
At this point in time, the homicide is still unsolved. That wasn't a gimmick. It really is unsolved. That's why we called the series Unsolved. I wanted a solid ending to the story. I really wish we knew who did it. I really wished that while I was reporting it, they solved it and I could say, oh, stop the presses. Here's a new installment where we say who did it. While I've been reporting this story, I've gotten to know the police in Hales Corners really well. So I've been in touch with them probably at least weekly about the investigation, and I'm guessing that will probably continue. And despite the odds, investigators like Chief Sarah are hopeful they'll crack the case and, as a result, bring some peace to John's brothers and his parents.
I can't be anything but positive that we're going to be able to solve it. If you're not positive, nothing good's going to come of it.
For Sarah, finding answers for John's parents and for his brothers, Mark and Phil, remains a top priority.
When I speak with Mark and I speak with Phil and I spoke with Johnny's dad, John, I can't even begin to tell them that I understand, because I don't. I'm not the victim. I can think I understand, but I can't understand, and I won't really know what it really does, what it'll mean in the end.
Obviously, John's family is never going to forget John, and even if they do solve the case, it will never be over for them. They all seem to have different ways of dealing with it. John's mother just can't talk about it, just has to kind of keep it in a box and not deal with it. John's father is a little bit more forthcoming in terms of he'll talk to Mark about it. He has talked to the police about it. John's younger brother, Phil, who's living out of state, seems extremely traumatized by the whole thing, even now. Mark told me one time that Phil was here visiting, and the parents and Mark wanted to go to this certain fish fry, but Phil wouldn't go because in order to get there, you had to drive past Whitnall Park. He's still so traumatized that he doesn't even want to drive past the park. And Mark kind of has gone in fits and starts. Sometimes he doesn't want to talk about it. Sometimes he really wants to talk about it and find out everything he can. And he, I think at this point, has just reached the point where he doesn't think it will ever be solved. And even if it is solved, and even if the police get a conviction, I don't know that he'll be convinced that they have the right person, because there have been so many false starts along the way. But I think what he is happy about at this point is just that his brother hasn't been forgotten.
Well, if my brother hadn't died, you know, when he was 14, I'd like to think if he was still alive today that he'd have a successful career and a family, you know, wife, some kids, maybe by now a couple grandkids, a place out in the country, because that's what he liked. He liked dogs and pets, so he'd probably have the nuclear family type kind of like ideal kind of thing. But, you know, one of the things that really bothers me is that the fact that he missed out on all that kind of stuff. You know, people tell you to let it go and forget about it, and you got to move on with your life, and I certainly have done that and do that, but I still, it's something I think about almost every single day.
Unsolved is produced by Katie O'Connell and narrated by me, Gina Barton, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Bill Schultz. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved. Special thanks to Mark Zara, Kent Schoonover, Eric Serra, Justin Landry, Paul Sculptor, and Michael Yaporsky. If you have information about the John Zara case, please contact the Hales Corners Police Department at 414-529-6140.